Last time we've seen a little bit of technical insight into how dispatching works in general in these mainstream object-oriented languages and also in a few extensions which are not so mainstream. And today we're going to continue in the spirit of this kind of dispatching by looking at a specific implementation of an object-oriented language, in this case C++, and how it deals with other features like multiple inheritance. Let's see how far we will come today. What I've planned to do today is that we're going to look at the different principles of inheritance, let it be interface inheritance or implementation inheritance, and also on a few particular choices on how to implement dispatching in these settings. Then let's have a look at how the memory layout looks like for the basic case and what single inheritance makes of that and how virtual methods fit into that scheme. Then we also look at how multiple inheritance changes the game, how virtual methods fare in that situation, and what we do with common parents. And also, I would like to shed light on something which is not done with the example that we see in the slides, which is linearization, which is special features that a few other object-oriented languages that have multiple inheritance have. And, this is about how to resolve ambiguously defined common parents. And there's certain choices, once again, how you can implement linearization with different algorithms. Okay, algorithms, and we will have a look at these. So let's start off with, we've seen a lot of inheritance on the last slides, but all we did was having one parent and several children, and like in real life, wouldn't it be nice to inherit from several parents, not only from one? So, in fact, we've already seen a few examples where we have something like multiple inheritance already. Come, feel free to serve yourself. We have a whole barrel that needs to be emptied until the end. Okay. If it's not empty, you won't get out of the room. Okay, so in order to talk about inheritance and its influences it has on the implementation, we need to differentiate between two specific types of inheritance that we have. So there's the notion of interface inheritance and implementation inheritance. And these are, at first notion, look quite similar, but they having quite different effect on the implementation. So, first of all, from a kind of design point of view, you know, in these kinds of software design and all that, I'm not a real expert because my heart's not really into these design choices, more on the technical part of the whole thing. However, what I've learned that these two things are good for is, typically for something like implementation inheritance, we have something like code reusage as the main goal for that. So the idea would be that by inheriting a certain method from my parent via implementation inheritance, what I essentially get is I get to reuse the code that has already been specified by my parent. So what I can do now is, as a subclass of my specific superclass, is that I can replace particular methods to implement my own behavior in order to specialize the things that I do while keeping to a few promises, particularly that I that as a subtype of a certain type, an object that is an instance of my type needs to be compatible with all the places where the supertype is allowed to be called and to be used. So that is the so-called Liskov substitution principle. Has anyone already heard about that term? One, two, three, four. Well, at least, more than one. It happens that I checked the beginner slides, and it's actually on there. So, but that's probably a minor detail for most of us. But in principle, it means that you can use this more specific type in all places where that are suited for using just the supertype. So that's what it actually says. So, yeah. In these situations, the parents act as a kind of a library for the children, where you can find the code that you want to reuse. And yeah, many languages are there out there which support such behavior. The most famous is probably C++, or for the more functional programmers, then it's something like Lisp. Okay, and then there's also the other notion of inheritance, which is this interface inheritance. What do I mean when I say interface inheritance? Well, in these cases, what I'm inheriting from a certain supertype is not an actual implementation of a certain method, but instead what I get is a kind of a contract that when I inherit from a certain subtype via interface inheritance, then I promise to provide a certain method with a certain signature. So it's a behavioral contract, what I'm doing when I inherit via interface inheritance. So in this case, what's happening is that the subtype then provides methods with signatures that have been predetermined by the parent. So there's no sharing in that sense of implementation, so there's no reusage of, at least, of the parent's code. But as I kind of promised to keep to certain conventions, like the signatures that I inherit via interface inheritance, this makes my subtype reusable at all the spots where probably someone else has defined an algorithm with objects in mind that expose a certain signature to the outside, with, to a type that has agreed to a certain behavioral contract. So that is what the interface inheritance is all about. And that is something that we can get with these, I would say, third-generation languages like Java or C#. And probably an example for you to illustrate what I actually want to say. So this is kind of a very crude class diagram of a machine, which is a bulldozer. And a bulldozer consists in two parts, in this model at least. It has an undercarriage, which moves the whole thing. And therefore it has, as a contract, all the undercarriage provides is actions to move to a certain location. And yeah, the other part that the bulldozer is composed of is the housing, where the bulldozer operator lives, or, well, not lives, but works. And the house has certain attachments that can be actuated, like, for example, can have a power shovel or a front loader. And both of them are special kinds of houses. So inheritance, in that sense, is, well, you could, instead of using this aggregation here, also inherit from these two in order to kind of make sure that you have a certain, you keep to certain, to a certain interface, and then implement them by by getting yourself such a power shovel and linking it to that housing here. I'm actually not really sure whether the arrows are really what I want to say here. I think they're kind of the other way around. So yeah, so that's probably not the nicest picture for that thing. But in principle, what is meant is that you have these interface contracts, and you have to fulfill them by plugging your own code in there, and afterwards, the bulldozer code is probably the one that is formulated in a way that you can, independently of the implementation, just use this contract. So, yeah, that would be the interface inheritance. Probably, I don't really know where to really apply all these things. Then there's implementation inheritance, where you just simply take over functionality from parents. So you have the ship, which can toot and move to, and then you can also have an airport, which gives shelter to planes, and from both of them, you can just inherit the functionality in order to build an aircraft carrier. So an aircraft carrier is an airport and a ship. Yeah, that's probably where the arrows are really showing what I want to say here in this case. Okay, so that's these two notions of inheritance. But how do we actually implement these things? And with that, I mean, how can we really bring it down to machine level? And as machine level is really, really hard to write and present on slides, and you probably don't want to see that, let's don't go straight to machine code, but instead use something pretty convenient that an open source product gives you, which is the LLVM, which has once been the low-level virtual machine and is now kind of a intermediate representation for all kinds of different front ends, which can be targeted, and then it's something which is pretty nice to read compared to actual low-level code. It has some at least a little bit of a notion of types, so you can have more typed code as you would have in comparable assembly languages, and a few nice constructs which are for low-level code are pretty abstract already, like the navigation within these composite structures. Okay. Yes, please. Yeah.
So
yeah,
they use this kind of low level language and then compile it further, or?
Yeah, you don't have to. That's probably wrong of me to call the whole thing LLVM. That it's not only this language to specify assembler on a higher level, which is called LLVM, but it's a complete compiler suite.
Okay. With
several fronts, and the LLVM IR, which stands for intermediate representation, is the part that we will use here. So that's what's in some way or another at some point produced by the whole tool chain, and we can intercept and take that out of the compiler before it is actually compiled down to the bare metal. So that's actually what I've written down here. So this Clang is a certain compiler front end for C and C++, which supports or is supported by the LLVM framework, and what it produces is in fact this LLVM intermediate representation, and this is then taken by the LLVM framework and brought down to the specific target machine. What this LLVM IR also gives you is a kind of a machine-independent format of assembly instructions, and at least with the basic knowledge about how to compose these kinds of intermediate programs, you can target also other machines. Of course, there's still a few machine-dependent things in there. For example, if you have a look at, well, you can't really see here, but there's the bitwidth of the addresses, for example, is kind of baked into the whole system by depending on whether the generated code uses these 64-bit integers for addresses or 32-bit addresses. So you can't really take a piece of code which has been implemented with a 64-bit machine in mind onto an 8-bit microcontroller and let it run because, well, just all the data types that are associated with addresses then just don't fit together. So, yeah, it's not so that you can literally take the code from one machine, move it on another, and then just execute. However, there have been a lot of projects that have had the vision of using this LLVM encoding to, for example, implement virtual machines for browsers in order to bring kind of almost binaries on a platform-independent way over the browser to your machine. And yeah, I think they didn't succeed in this case because people didn't want to use especially the LLVM IR, but there's still projects that target something like this. However, this whole LLVM toolchain is something which is quite popular in the compiler area. So people who are doing research on compilers like this LLVM and the IR, which is associated with that, quite a lot. And it's also quite easy to access, and there are a lot of tools around to inspect and to modify and to generate code for or to use the code. And it's a quite a livid framework, so there's a lot happening there. And yeah, I use it here because it's really easy to get a lot of information about the code that you have generated. For example, the other thing that might be interesting is to retrieve the memory layout of a compilation unit. There's another call just for that with the dump record layouts, which will be quite useful later on when we have more complicated class layouts. Yes, please. If you specify an input file, then this is a kind of a collection of several loosely related functions, and the compilation unit is kind of the one that grabs all of them into one thing, which is then called the compilation unit. That has been all the things that have been specified in one file, essentially, and. So in this case, that's why you asked. Yeah, for one source file here, I have extracted the memory layout with just this specific instruction. Yeah. So the compilation unit, that's kind of a specification speak, so to say. So if you have a look at the standard for C++ or for C, then you will find the term compilation unit as one of the topmost terms for a group of functions that are specified in one file. It's kind of grammar related, so I don't exactly know the C++ grammar right now, but I would assume that the compilation unit would then encompass several classes. So, yeah. It's a grammar thing. That's also why you can find it in the specification. Yeah. Okay. So in order to read that well, I won't use the whole syntax that LLVM offers to us in the slides that follow. But a few of the things that we will see repeatedly, I have assembled here on that slide. So is it that I'm going to use? So there will be these struct definitions. These are, well, probably start from the very beginning. Variables in LVMIR always start with a percent sign and then an arbitrary identifier. So that's always variable names. There's the assignment operator, and here I specify a new type. This is started with a type keyword, and then there's a block, and within the block I can specify what's in the type. So I can use type names here, for example, I32, which would correspond to a 32-bit integer. I can also specify signatures of function pointers. So there's the pointer in there, and this one belongs to the function. This says that it's a function that returns an I32 and as a parameter of I32. So it's very compact, but it's still a function pointer. If it happens to you that on one of the following slides where I used that syntax, you don't remember exactly what it means, then just ask. It shouldn't be the problem of not understanding exactly the syntax of that thing, so just ask that, if it helps in understanding. Then you can also recursively use other type names in there. So, for example, I can use struct B for the second component of that struct, and I have to look up what struct B is then, and this is another type, and this type now has a few different things. It uses, for example, differently a particular other integer, which is 64-bit, and one that is 8-bit, so I can vary the bit width of my data types. Then there's also notions of specifying arrays, and that's what you see here. So this is an array of 20 times 32-bit integers, and this is composable, so you can also do two-dimensional arrays here. So this is an array of 10 times 20 30-bit integers, 32-bit integers, sorry. Good, so that's already a little bit more abstract than you would get it on the native code somewhere. Then you can also have things like memory allocations. In this case, I only have the stack allocation mentioned here, but there's also heap allocation that you can do. But for the purposes that we need here, stack allocation is already enough. So with something like that, I can allocate space for a struct A type on the stack and assign its address to a certain identifier, percent A. Then, and this is the nice feature here, which is more abstract than what you get on the native machines, is this get element pointer thing. This is the navigation instruction, which tells you if you have a composed type where to navigate inside that. If you want to kind of access a certain member of a structure in LVM intermediate representation, you need to have two instructions. First of all, you need to specify which of the fields you want to access. That's done with the get element pointer, and this kind of returns a descriptor of where to find this thing. So the get element pointer gives a descriptor to the place that I want to navigate to into this temporary variable %1. And then there's an actual load instruction, which then is used to get the things that I'm interested in to do the memory access for that. So it's a twofold thing. First of all, you need to kind of move a pointer somewhere in memory to where you want to obtain your data from, and then you do the actual load. So it's this twofold thing that you need here. That's something that's confusing a few people in the beginning. Yes? So the get element pointer defines where the pointer should be. Yeah. It's also something which is quite on an abstract level. So what this get element pointer here... Oh, sorry, I didn't see you.
If you have the struct B there, is this already a command that you have to run?
you can have pretty complex expressions by just adding more to the comma separated list of indices over here. So this is already doing a few things here. So we should probably wait with answering that before we have talked about what that list here means. So first of all, what you do is you the first parameter is the your kind of basic anchor into the memory where you want to start with setting the pointer where to load from. And that's going to an object that we have created before. So that was this one. And for this one, we have already gotten memory that is able to store one of these struct A's. So that's pointing to a memory somewhere. And then I have a comma-separated list of just constants, which are used as hierarchically interpreted indices in this. So first of all, what I need to be careful of is that I have a pointer here to that. And pointers and arrays are something which is quite similar. So the first index will kind of navigate into this array, so to say, which is the same thing as the pointer here. So the first thing is just to kind of get into this pointer type, which is this struct A then. And in the struct A, I now navigate two fields to the right. Well, that's not what I wanted to say. I access the second field, which is when we start with null indices, which is actually the third thing. So the blue thing was pointing us conceptually to the place in memory. Always the same. So let's just ignore that this, over here. This is just the data specification. But actually, we would work on an instance of a struct. So the zero would go into the yes, please. This would be the second. The size. So it's already taking the type of the pointer into account because this has a certain length, and it's zero times the length in this case. I want to select the second field in a null index, index-based or zero-index-based field collection. So this will then navigate to the 0, 1, 2, this one here.
So this one is actually a value of 2, not the amount of times you're going to move an I-64.
Yeah. They're dependent on the type. So the first level type that we access is an array type. There everything has the same size. That's why I can just multiply with a fixed size. On the second level, when I move into the type, then I have a composite type, which is composed of several differently large things. And there I just I navigate in a more abstract way by counting the slots.
So in the sense, pointer type is I-64 length?
Well, it does not really matter here how large it really is because there's no connection to the actual pointer size over here, except for that the implementation of the get element pointer must know. You cannot really say that. It's not always I-64. It depends on the machine on which this is interpreted, and for which it's just not fixed. It's not a real assembler. It's more abstract than a real assembler. Yeah.
The second level, do we actually have to use I-64 because if they're just
These. Yeah, it wouldn't matter. I think it's just. I think it doesn't matter.
It's actually constants. This is how it treats. I mean, number two, for example, yeah. It says where to go and get it filled, so it doesn't matter if it's yeah. I32. Yeah. If you say just constant two, and you get that filled, then this is the third
function. So the first one
is like that difference between, for example, I have compiled it, and I got I32 because my machine was like.
But why do you write as a symbol then?
Even for constants, you have to fix the type, so to say. Yeah. But actually, it's just for reading purposes here, so we don't really need to really come down with it. I think it's because I've compiled on a 64-bit machine, and the default type for the constants would have been 64 in this case. So, yeah, but it's not really fixed in the specification of the intermediate language. You did the lab course on the LLVM, didn't you? Okay. So you're probably more fluent in the whole thing than me. But anyway, yeah. So what that managed to do now was to make the percent one point to the location in memory where this function pointer would be stored within this object. So there's a descriptor for that, and next thing is, well, in the end, we want, or this code at least aims for calling that specific pointer that is pointed to by this memory area. So what it does is, next, it is loading from this thing, and once again, it does a typed load here. So the type of the person 2 now is this method pointer returning I32 and taking I32 as parameter. So that's what's in the concretely in percent two now. And then I can use percent two to call this specific method now. That's what I can do with my call expression. I need to use the type. Then I use the reference to the memory which I have created in my sequence of instructions over here, and also I use another constant for which I once again use a specific type in order to just specify what I mean when I write 42. And this gives us a return value. So that's what you have to keep in mind at least a little bit. I would try to have commented examples in the later slides and also try to talk about things in depth when they occur so that you have a chance of understanding. Otherwise, ask me or her. So, good. Anyway, if you're not sure on what the compiler would do with a certain high-level feature, you can, every time when you're not sure, you can just retrieve the particular code from your source code by just compiling it down with Clang. It's installed on your virtual machine that all of you have, so you can just use that if you're eager to know a little bit more about that. It turns out that actual LLVM code is a little bit more complicated than just that, so you might have to look around a little bit in the file that's produced from that. And also there's a few more things that litter your code with a lot of annotations that you probably aren't interested as a human being, but they are meant to assist the next compiler phase in compiling a more performant code. But that would be the kind of level on which I want to talk about what all these features actually do. So first of all, if we do just plain single inheritance, what does that do on an intermediate representation level? So let's have few high-level examples. There's class A, which is just an attribute in the method, same as class B, which has an attribute in the method, same as C, and C inherits from B, B inherits from A, so we have a whole inheritance structure here, which is three deep. And just to be curious, what the whole system does is, well, I also try to use it a little bit and call one of the methods. So what does it do on the intermediate representation level? I've always given you the data type specifications, which can be found in the very beginning of such a file. They determine how the memory layout actually looks like. So you might wonder what's actually the minimally necessary parts that you need in order to represent a class of type C, B, or A in memory. And for that, we might have a look at the components which form these things. And for these classes, so far, we only have attributes and functions. And the question is, which of these components are the ones that can be reused, or and which are the ones that are unique for one of these object representations? And if you want to instantiate such a class, all you need to keep is if you only have a look at these features here, you only need to represent the attributes of these things, because they vary from object instance to object instance. One of the basic principles in compiling is that you, for each of the object instances, you can reuse the code that you have specified through for the class of all these objects. So for the methods, we only we reuse the code. The attributes, however, we can't reuse because each of them needs its individual attribute, so we need to keep that in the object representation. Thus, my object representation for something like C would look like just the collection of all the attributes that are specified within C or its ancestors. So I have A, B, and C in there. This looks, on the compiler side, this looks like A would just consist of one attribute. B is then composed of its own attributes and the things that that make up A. So first of all, I have the content from A, and then I extend it with my own attribute of type I32. Then there's class C, which is composed of everything from class B. This also incorporates, of course, everything from class A and extends it with I32. That's why we have this specific look of the object. It's composed from all its supertypes, and it begins with the most supertypes attributes, and then is extended. So this one is like this, and then is extended step by step by each of the subclasses specifically specified members. So if I now have a look at what a function call is looking like, so first of all, we need to make room for a new C. So what I do there is I do an allocation of my class C. And yeah, next thing is that I want to call, for example, method G with my beloved 42. So let's have a look at what this actually means. So what I want to do is I want to call this G. G, as we have heard already in the last slide, is a function that has how many arguments? Well, not one, but two, because implicitly also the receiver reference, which comes in front. Oh, no, not like this. Which comes in front of the calling expression in Java, C++, and all these things. So this is actually the first parameter of the whole thing. So the thing that I want, will call will have not only the integer as parameter, but also the thing that will then within the object be accessible as this, which is called the receiver of the message or function call. All these this terminology of receiver and all that dates back to the times of small talk, where objects would receive messages or send messages and all these things. And yeah, that's why the this first special parameter is the receiver. Meanwhile, it has been the whole thing has been renamed to methods instead of messages. So the receiver is a little bit out of context, but that's why everyone talks about the receiver over here. So that's the first parameter. And apart from that, I can clearly just read where to obtain this G from. So what I just do is I will write it straight down as a constant, and it will get, well, it was the wrong color. So the receiver will go, no, the receiver will go in there, and the first parameter over here will go in there. Next thing is that for in order to call this thing from typing perspective, G is specified as belonging to the type B over here. That's why we need type B for the receiver over here. In order to obtain that, we do a bitcast, which is just, well, doing nothing except of informing the type system that I'm going to interpret this this pointer as something different over here, at least for now. Okay, why is it so important to talk about something like layout over here and what's happening over here? Well, that has to do with how the method bodies themselves are actually implemented. So if you think back at, I think, last talk, I probably already have mentioned that the basic principle of compilation, at least for a static compiler without any special optimizations or runtime support, the basic concept is that there's only one implementation of your method body around. You don't specialize it for each of the occurrences that you find throughout a program or for each of the subclasses. You will always have one specific implementation. Well, that's for saving space, for example, but also to keep things concise and doable without having to prepare all combinations and all stuff. So in principle, you only have one implementation of the whole thing. So that's what we see here. That's the method that we have called on the last slide. And also, I have given you now the implementation of the method here. What it does is it adds its parameter to the attribute. So it has a parameter p, it should be blue, p, and the attribute over here. So it connects a few things that are conceptually treated differently. So from a conceptual point of view, the parameter is something that is handled either via register or via stack or whatever you might imagine on your concrete implementation. This thing is a little bit more abstract than your barebone machine, and gives you the notion of a parameter to a function call, and you can name it and use it throughout your implementation of a method body. So for this, we have the name %p directly to access that thing. And then for that, well, that's already pretty nice. We need that in order to perform our addition. The next thing that we need is now the attribute. So how do we get the attribute? For that, we need to somehow access our object representation, which keeps our current version of B somewhere inside. And for that, we need to address within this pointer. First of all, with 0, we access the first thing in this virtual array, and then we access the 0-based first slot in the type that we get from that, which is class B. So it's going to this thing, which is corresponding to exactly that slot that we have reserved for B within our object representation. Welcome. Have a cup. Anyway, next thing would be to then load from the descriptor that we have constructed first with the getElement pointer, and then we can, in the end, perform the addition with the add thing, which then couples the retrieved value from the attribute together with the parameter. Yes, please? Where should I use the object A?
No, I mean class B is inherited from class A, so the object will be also a class A object, right?
Yeah, you can access the attribute from A in a similar manner, but just replacing this thing with 0, then we would get the A. Because in a B object, you also represent A's part, and you know that this is the So this is not exactly what's happening here. So in this case, you would have selected the slot for A. So you would probably also once again need another 0 or something to go inside this reference to the first slot.
No, I mean, from the get element pointer, instead of class B, you put class A.
Yeah, but B doesn't exist in A. B inherits A from A.
You mean you want to change that? No, that wouldn't work. Because well, of course, I do that. But in this case, the getElement pointer is something which is context-dependent. If it is called with something which has the type A, then it doesn't know how to interpret the 0, 1, the second slot, because there's just no second slot there. So in there, there's a lot of color there, so let's probably reduce it to what you wanted to do. If you have an A here, then you would first of all try to do dereferentiation. So you are inside the A now, and then you would have to select the second thing, but there is nothing here. And of course there is something, but for that you would have to do a typecast. But, well, there is typecasting happening a lot in the examples that are generated from source code, and you will see a few of them later on, but they're pretty ugly and are not really what you would expect the whole thing to do, but it just works because it happens to match with the sizes that are valid on your machine, and it's a mess. But it's, yeah, you'll see a few of these things. Anyway, conceptually, the important thing to take away from there is, although on the last slide we have generated a C object, we still managed to reuse the code that we have once written for B, because the memory layout for A, B, and C keep to the convention that the extensions happen later on. So you can use methods that that think that they are working on a certain supertype. You can reuse them because all they have in their visibility are attributes that that have been specified by some subtype, as some supertype, of course. So for these, there's a fixed sequence where the memory locations for these attributes actually can be found, and the subtype still keeps to this sequence. So you can use a fixed index to access them. So where was it you? No? Okay. Good. So the thing is, reusing is a important thing, and the other thing is, in order to reuse, you need to provide the right types for your receiver parameter, and this differs in how you can get to this thing. In this case, it's just a new interpretation of the thing, which is just a bit cast. There might be some architecture where there's code behind this bitcast, but in most cases you would just be fine with doing nothing here. Okay, so that's how a method body is actually implemented. Then, if you think back at last time we were talking about single dispatching. For that, there was something more happening. We didn't just do static dispatching like the one that we had on the slide before, but we could just directly mention the constant which is associated with the function that we want to call. So its functions are not constant anymore in dynamic single dispatching, but instead you have to find the most recent implementation of your method. So there's several ways how to come to such a dispatching mechanism. And the one that you have seen is the one which uses a kind of a runtime support, where the whole dispatching mechanism is executed at runtime and also provided by the runtime. So this would, well, this is just pseudocode over here now, so that's not exactly what you would find in that, because actually this LVM thing does not really offer runtime dispatching in the way that we have seen it on the last talk. But conceptually, what it would correspond to is a direct call to a generic dispatching function like this, where you would also give your receiver class in order to obtain the class chain, in order to search through the superchain for your most recent implementation, and also you would give it a kind of an encoding of the signature that you would like to find in there. Well, as this is just artificial anyway and doesn't exist, I just took some constant over here. But in principle, you would have to encode all your virtual method names and parameter types into some encoding and give it to the dispatcher, and the dispatcher would then start to look through the superchain and look through all the entries there for an implementation of that encoding, and then in the end return it in order to call it. So that's what the first Java interpreters did, and probably a few other interpreters of, for example, JavaScript or whatever you want to run, did in the beginning. And that is, you can imagine, that's just slow as hell. So what came then is people who said, well, virtual method call is really essential for object-oriented languages, especially for the ones who only offer virtual dispatching, and we need to make that really fast. So there were people who were saying, well, then let's just specialize our code a little bit, and this led to the invention of just-in-time compilation, or in that case, the hotspot compiler for Java in this case. So what it actually does is if you call such a dynamic dispatch for the first time, what it does is it will create an alternate version of your code where it will just hard code the thing that has been found by the dispatcher as a constant into your call. And so say, well, we assume that next time we arrive at this special program point, I will just assume that we will have met the same an object of the same class once again, and it would be probably pretty valid to just call the function implementation or the method implementation that we have found via the dispatcher for the first time just once again. Yeah, that's probably in a few cases or quite often the case. However, you still need to make sure that you do the right thing. So conceptually, that's not, once again, not real code, but just the conceptually what has to happen here is that you need to verify that the class that you're talking about is really a state the same. So what you would do is you would generate such an assertion code which would check that the, in this case, I have assumed that I have found my specific code within class D, that each time I reach this program point that I am still having an object of type D here. So what I do is I, at some point, try to obtain information about which class my object is actually implementing, and yeah, there are usually pointers from your object or object representation into some descriptor data structure which you can try to query, and yeah, that's what I conceptually do in the first two lines. Don't look too closely. What I mean is you just have to check for one address, load it from there, and then compare it to something that you have remembered from last time that you visited that specific program point. And in case that the assertion holds, all you can do now is, instead of going through the whole superchain and looking for the right implementation, you can just do a call to a constant, which is almost static dispatching at that point, just with one memory dereference and comparison before. In cases where you have a real found a hotspot in your code, and it happens that you hit a lot of similarly classed objects, this is working out quite fine. So that's what the aggressive inlining and caching approach would be. So that's what's happening in your hotspot machines. Another approach to this is the thing that, well, for specific objects at runtime, you will always, when you search for a certain specific identifier with this concrete object, you will always end up with the same answer. So the idea would be to not perform the whole of the run through the superchains at runtime, but instead do all the possible lookups at compile time and store them in some kind of dispatching table. So that gives you a whole two-dimensional matrix, which is indexed on in one dimension with your concrete object identity and in the other direction with the specific signature of your method or the encoding into an integer or something. And with that, you can just have your table lookup with two dimensions, and with that you can obtain your memory address that you want to jump to. So this would be the implementation with a full two-dimensional matrix. However, this will create you a large, really large data structure which has all the encodings of signatures that you might imagine as one dimension and all the classes as the other dimension, and there's a lot of free spaces in there. So, yeah, we have an example of that over here. This would be the whole two-dimensional matrix with the signatures in one direction and the classes in the other direction, and only the valid combinations would have actually an entry. All the others would say there's no entry for that. And yeah, in statically typed programming languages, the empty fields are not really necessary because the whole system would just not compile anything that would enable a call of K, for example, on a B object, because, well, there's just no type that corresponds to something that has a K implementation and belongs to B. So this would never happen. However, in dynamic languages like JavaScript or Lua or whatever you might imagine, you can just specify anything on the source level, and you need to find out whether there's actually an implementation hidden somewhere or whether that's just bullcrap that's happening there. So, yeah, you need to keep these situations apart from situations where there's valid implementations of methods somewhere. However, this full two-dimensional matrix is wasting a lot of memory. It's that's something that is not done in practice. Instead, there have been proposals for saving memory by just taking each of these entries, for example, this one and this one, and realizing that there's a whole lot of space, just not used, like this one. Why should I keep that? I could instead try to compress that by moving the beginning of the second list just at the beginning of the free space over here. And I could do so, the same for the next row. I could put that in the beginning of the free space over here, which would then correspond to some place over here. So I could move all these lines of my matrix next to each other, reusing the space that has been left free from the other, from its predecessor line. This would essentially lead to a table like the one that you see over here. The only thing that you need to memorize now is the start point for each of these classes. So for A, I'd have to memorize that it's starting over here. For B, it's starting over here. For F, it's starting over here. This is not not giving you everything in the sense of that now all the empty slots are used in a meaningful way. If you have happen to have empty slots in here like this, which is not connected to the end of the line, then you will still find these empty slots in the displacement dispatch table. However, you these are really, really sparse tables, and for the concrete examples of single and multiple dispatch, multiple inheritance and reuse of methods and all that, you can find quite nice interleavings of these lines so that it saves a lot of the memory that you would have just wasted on the two-dimensional displacement dispatch on the two-dimensional tables which associate signatures and concrete classes. Of course, there's still... Yes, please? As long as they are one contiguous block, you can You can reuse the complete first such block that you find, but as soon as you hit the first entry, at least in the naive version, you have to start your dispatching area. Yes. Yes. Of course, you could try to optimize for space by not just enumerating one after the other, but try to find a nice distribution of encodings, a nice assignment of encodings to signatures. That's some kind of optimization problem that the compiler can solve. The other idea would be to get rid of uniform encoding of or unique encoding of a signature and move over to assign them different specialized encodings depending on which class family they belong to, and yeah, with that you can get even more compacted memory areas, and also you are in many cases able to reuse fractions of these tables by giving them the same entry point, especially for example in the case over here, where you have class A and class B, and A in this case probably has B has inherited from A in this case, because it has just the same implementation of F, and then it has an own extension of a method which is this G, and there's no point in separating the dispatch table for those because in both cases F has the same entry, so it's the dispatch table for A is just a sub table of the dispatch table for B, so you can make them share the table space. And putting all that together, you will end up with something which you might already know by name, which is the virtual tables. That is the keyword that gets thrown at your head if you ask dumb questions about virtual methods. Well, let's have a look at how they really work, because they're not as simple as you might think because of all these specific tricks that you have to do in order to reuse the space. So they're a one-dimensional displacement table with certain tricks applied to save on space. So if we now start with virtual methods in this thing, we need virtual dispatching. And how that is done is that the conceptual run through the superchain of supertypes is kind of pre-computed and stored alongside your type in a displacement table, which is called the virtual method table. And if we have simple object layout as we have it, for example, here, where there's just a base class a class B inheriting from A, and a class C inheriting from B, then let's have a look at what's happening here. We have functions F, G, and H, and they are step-by-step replaced with more specific implementations. There's G in B and H in C. And if we now start by creating a new object of type C, and then try to call method G with 42 once again. Let's have a look at how this is translated. First of all, the memory layout is now a little bit more different than before. We have for class A now something that we cannot really decipher from just the first glance. And then there's our attribute A, which we know from last object layout already. Then there's class B, and now it's really really messy, because in there we have compiler-generated scrambled addresses here, which is or just memory area over here. That happens if you do practical examples in lectures. It turns out that this corresponds exactly to the space that is needed to insert an object of class A in there. You will see that later on when we look into the assembly code, but you see in practice not everything is so nice as it is in theory. In principle, what we would like to find over here is just class A in there. But it happens to be of the same size as the array over there, and the compiler finds it more likable to use the an array as a type over here and likes to cast later on. Well, I haven't found any anything to circumvent that. You want to decipher what this I-32 thing is?
I'm assuming it's a virtual function.
It's, well, it's a pointer to function pointers. So it's the virtual table. I just didn't want to talk about the type right now, but it's a pointer to the virtual table.
So it would be added to the type of V as well?
Yeah. So it happens that it fits exactly into this 12-byte slot over there, and via inserting class A in there, which is what happens.
No, I mean, if you have another function in B, which is also virtual, you will again add this parameter of pointer to function pointers into the type of B, separate from the definition of A.
It happens that the pointer to the virtual pointer is not really in the object representation itself, because for all the objects that are instances of the class, they are the same. So we keep them centralized apart from the object representation and point to the place where they are stored with the virtual function with the virtual table pointer. So it's just one pointer in there, and it gets embedded into class B and class C with this recursive type names.
But you would add the pointer to the class type if you had another virtual function in class B.
Class type. Well, the type here does not really say a lot about what the actual types of these things are. It really uses this three dots over here to designate that doesn't care about the type of the parameters, so you don't need to modify this.
Yes, but I understand. If you add virtual functions to a class, you can always just add this field that says there are virtual functions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you do it in B, you would actually have this twice. Once in its definition of my superclass A, mm-hmm. which is virtual functions, and mm-hmm. once my own virtual functions.
You might think so. However, I've shown you before that if you have a similar layout, you reuse, and it reuses the virtual table pointer in this case, because it's just needed once.
And if it's a different function type, if A had, if B had a function that A didn't have?
It doesn't need to be the same value. It just needs to have the same slot. So I can point to a different table when I'm in class, an object of class B.
So your virtual function pointers will always be in one field. They won't
yes.
be separated.
Well, at least for now. It's complicated, I said so. Yeah, but for now, as we just have single inheritance and there's no need for separated virtual tables, because for virtual tables you can or for several of these things, because each situation that you can maneuver yourself into with just single inheritance and virtual methods, you will be able to reuse this concept of assuming that your subtype, your supertype, has a fixed sequence of elements that you know, and so you can just extend all these components, the object representation and the virtual table, in the end. So, for C, how do I generate a representation for that? These are the instructions. They are, in principle, they have the same attributes with themselves as they had on the in the example without virtual methods, and they also have references to the to their supertypes in embedded. It's just not called in there, but believe me, they will be in there by the construction. It's just a typing thing over here. And the topmost supertype declares, the supertype that's farthest to the top, which introduces a virtual method, and also introduces the virtual table pointer into the whole hierarchy. So that's happening in type A over here, because it's the first type where the virtual table is actually happening. So via the embedding of types, this virtual table pointer is also accessible from all the subtypes. So for the memory layout of class C, what we will get is this thing that we have seen before, which is just A, B, and C as attributes, as well as the virtual table pointer. And this is pointing to a memory area that resides inside this displacement table that you have conceptually seen on the slides before. They are very specialized. For each of the types, you have a different section in the table. They might overlap at some point, but only if it's really safe to use them in an overlapped way. So for type C, you will get a pointer into that table that points to an area which has certain conventions. It will have you will find the address of the method that you need to use in order to execute calls to F in the first thing, the pointer to the implementation that you need to use for calls to B to G in the next, and the one for H in the last. So that's what these entries need to be interpreted as, and as the compiler can pre-compute all these runs through the superchain, it will do so for the classes A, the classes B, and the classes C, and it will use the results that it gets for class C to store them in there. It will do the same thing for class B. We can create a representation for B over here. So B, what will it be like for object representation? Well,
we won't have integer C.
But instead, we will have a virtual table pointer, and we will have an int A and an int B, but no C. This will point to this one? Not necessarily. So it will point to a virtual table, and it will have this virtual table will have slots for F and G, but not for H, because H is, well, of course, also for H, because H is known to A. So it will have three slots. And what will it have inside? It will have AF inside. It will have, well, it's a B, and it overrides overwrites G, so it will have B, G, and for H, it will have, well, AH, like this. And, yeah. So, why is that important? Well, it has, once again, the same properties as you have seen on the slides before. When you have a code that expects something of type B to be there, and it happens to obtain a reference to C at some point, it can still operate on the same thing, because the indices to the attributes A and B are actually the same in C and B. Also, the implementations, the concrete implementations of F, G, and H have the same indices from the beginning of these things. So that's what counts. You need to keep to the conventions that have been introduced by your supertypes. You can just extend in the end. Yeah, and I think that's exactly what happens over there. I now try, what do I do? I think I try to call the G over there, and what it does, different to before, is that it uses an indirect call here. So we will call to a variable that we have to compute somehow. And how is it computed? Well, there's a pair of load and get element pointer, and we can have a look at what this is, where this is navigating in. It navigates in %1, which is obtained by just loading the first element inside this C V pointer, which is just something which is obtained from the first line. So let's decipher the first line. What it does is it just casts the pointer to the pointer to C. So this thing, it casts to another type, which is just a pointer to the virtual table. Then it obtains or dereferences the virtual table with load into variable number one. And in there now, so what the first two things have done is they have gone the way over there. And the next thing is now that we select the first entry in the data structure that we have there, and it's just an array of function pointers. And by selecting the first entry, we select this one. And this is BG. This will be obtained from the virtual table with the load, and can then be used to be called. Good. So now, the burning question was, how do we include several parent objects into our system now? And now that we have the basics, and we have already run out of time, so I think we will have to finish on multiple inheritance next time. But now we have the basics on what's actually happening on the intermediate level, at least, which is not so difficult to find a mapping to the machine code afterwards. So anyway, we still have to continue next time, and this will be in next year then, I think in the second or third week of January.
Last line,
okay.
I'm wondering how you access to the binary data.
You have to cast a lot. it's really doing typecast. I think it probably managed the memory like that because I didn't put an access to A in there, because this would have been more easy if I would have explicitly said that that I need to access it somehow, and then it would probably generate the data structures accordingly. But I just couldn't bother with generating all the possibilities for that. There are a few examples later on where there's a lot of casting going on, especially on areas like this one. But I think they are later on. But yeah, the only thing that it can do now is introducing bit casts to the right type, and only then get element pointer will work accordingly. Good. This is the last question, then I think we'll finish for today. If you like to obtain another cup, you are free to do so. And apart from that, for people who won't show up tomorrow, have nice holidays and an Happy New Year and whatever you'd like to celebrate in these days. We'll meet again next year. I think it's around the 12th? Oh, let's check probably. 14th, am I right? Is that? I think this would probably be the next date for us to meet, because 7th is probably the holiday. Well, I will check that and I will remove it from your timetables in TUM Online if there's something to remove. And it's a normal day.
6th is a holiday.
6th is a holiday. Okay, so we'll probably see us on 7th, and then also tutorial is just regularly on 8th.
But
7th
is the Thursday.
8th is it's still December. Oh, flipping. Yeah, okay, so January we have the 4th. Okay. 6th is would be the next date.
6th is a holiday.
Okay, so then we'll see us on the 13th in the next year. Tutorial on 7th does not take place, but on 14th and tomorrow.
Tomorrow
is also tutorial. Yes. Okay. Good.
Zukunft. Was?